every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern in Studio B. www.freedomslips.com and revolution.radio. Check it out.
People's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We've got to stop them. They're going to kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio.
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think that the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome. This is the special live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. It's your welcome to the weekend Truth Jihad Radio special right here on Revolution.radio, the greatest of listener-sponsored free speech networks. If you care about free speech, and there are getting to be fewer and fewer platforms available for genuinely free speech on the Internet, please do help support Revolution.radio. And you can also subscribe to my Substack by way of truthjihad.com, and just click on the subscribe at Substack button. I'm Kevin Barrett of truthjihad.com, waging the all-out struggle for truth here since 2006 on a long list of different networks, culminating in the finest of all, revolution.radio. So tonight, all right, great show lined up here. Two of my favorite guests who come on periodically. In the second hour, Lin Din is returning after a long absence because he's been in the wrong time zones to get on this show. He spent the 2 years of the plandemic or scamdemic or whatever you want to call it, traveling all around the world, staying one step ahead of the brain police and the lockdowns and the vax mandates. He traveled through Laos and Cairo, Alexandria, Aswan, Tirana, Cape Town, and on and on and on, long list of places. And finally, just in as Putin ended the scamdemic by invading Ukraine, Lin managed to get back to Vietnam. And so he's going to talk to us live from Vietnam in the second hour, God and the Internet willing. Okay, first hour guest, Professor Thaddeus Kaczynski, has been telling it like it is for a long time and somehow managing to stay afloat in academia. I don't know how he does it. They chase me out with torches and pitchforks, and he's just as hardcore of a truth jihadi as I am, as you'll find out if you read his new article, Foucault Told the Truth. Well, yeah, Foucault told the truth. They can handle that in the academy. But if they read what Thaddeus Kaczynski says about the truth that Foucault told and how it applies to our age, they're probably going to get out those torches and pitchforks. But anyway, hopefully Thaddeus can ward them off and tell it like he sees it right here on Truth Jihad Radio. So, hey, welcome, Thaddeus Kaczynski. It's great to have you back.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing? Good to be here.
Yeah, wonderful to have you back. It sure has been a crazy time. It's one darn thing after another. And so Foucault, you know, that brings me back to my graduate school days when Foucault and postmodernism were all the rage. Yeah, it was kind of a nihilism. The basic philosophy there is that we can't really know the truth. We can't know much of anything. Everything we think we know is constructed by power, and we're part of a sort of a network of power that we don't even see, and it speaks us, it creates us, and there's really not a whole lot of hope for breaking out of it in the postmodern and Foucault kind of way of looking at things. And so you took a slightly different tack on Foucault, one that wouldn't win you too many points with the postmodernists I used to work with. So what does Foucault have to say about what's going on with the scamdemic and other such things?
Well, it's pretty simple, I think, to me. It's basically just that these people like Foucault and Derrida, and then before him, those two, Nietzsche, you know, and all the way back to Thrasymachus and Plato's Republic, saying that justice is the will of the stronger, and Protagoras saying that man is the measure of truth, right? These are claims that are true when you're talking about a thoroughly corrupt system of discourse or culture or politics. That is how politics, culture, discourse, lifestyles, you know, religion, whatever you want to say, ethics, that's how it works when it's corrupt. And in other words, when it's detached from reality, when it's detached from God and the Logos. And I say in my subtitle, Foucault was right about the kingdom of darkness. That's, you know, hell. If you read Dante's Inferno, discourse is manipulative. It's deceptive. The discourse between, conversations between Dante and the damned. You know, that's what our discourse is right now, or becoming, kind of hell on earth, where everything is manipulative. Everything is vampire-ish. People's from the top down, at the top, you have people who you would never want to even be next to or near, let alone speak with, because every word out of their mouths is a poisonous trap to put you under their power. Well, I think, you know, that's how a narcissist behaves. You've written on narcissism and studied it, psychopath narcissism. Well, it's a macrocosm now of this, and it's affecting everyone. And the best of us are tainted by it and are tempted to instead of using language to communicate truth and love, you know, we're being tempted to use it for manipulative purposes for our own power. And I think that's the greatest temptation that's being foisted upon us since the pandemic and now what I call the Ukraine insane. That's my TM. I made that up. That's mine.
Do we have to pay you a nickel every time we say that?
I haven't heard anyone say it yet but me, but anyway, that's what I think. And I think these writers like Foucault, he was himself a very unethical person. Let's put it that way. He was known to, you know, inhabit the bathhouses in was he in San Francisco? I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, he was in the Bay Area during the height of the sexual liberation movement there that gave rise to the AIDS pandemic.
Yeah, Nietzsche himself had syphilis because of his almost like a, I think a willful decision against God at some point to go to a brothel, if I remember, if that's correct. And so, you know, we either conform desire to truth or truth to desire. And so what they're doing is they're sort of giving an archaeology, to use Foucault's word, term, of the demented spirit and mind. And they're very accurate about it. I mean, once you begin with the premise that there is no love in the world and truth is simply the statements of the powerful, then you go from there. And I think the hidden grammar, as E. Michael Jones would say, of our discourse is Foucauldian, and the actions are Foucault. Everything's Foucauldian, but you have people who don't want to admit this, right? So this is why Foucault is a little more honorable, because he would admit this and say, look, it's all power. Stop virtue signaling. Stop telling us that this is the truth. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. No, there are none. There never was. It's simply recognizing the thoroughly manipulative nature of discourse and then negotiating your way in it to get the most power. Who admits that today? You know, they don't admit that. And maybe if that were admitted, people would see it and be disgusted, or some people would love it. But the point is, it's hidden with this smarmy kind of what I call like an antichrist veneer, because the antichrist is going to, you know, this antichrist spirit is to be more Christian, more virtuous, more loving than Christ. Right. So he's not going to come out as a Foucauldian, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the people who are playing the victim and getting power by pretending to either be the victim or to sympathize with victims, sort of playing this game that Rene Girard tells us has been going on since the rise of Christianity. But now in the post-Christian era, it's kind of gone off the rails. And so we have people who are making good livings and getting accumulating power by making statements as if they were themselves oppressed and powerless, and or they were identifying with and standing up for those who are oppressed and powerless, when in fact it's all a big game for them to get more power. When some people would describe the Democratic Party as essentially doing that and very little else. I think this Foucault analysis of yours is onto something, and it almost makes me wonder if the perpetrators of the scamdemic and perhaps 9/11 and other things have been reading Foucault alongside Orwell as a sort of how-to manual.
Yeah.
And actually, that's not really as outrageous as it sounds, because if you go back and look at the Straussian neoconservative philosophy, he was heavily influenced by Nietzsche and moved into that postmodern paradigm of believing, you know, this being a complete nihilist, believing that there's no good, no truth. It's all just the only truth is the word of the stronger. And the only moral law is the law that the stronger has the right. The only right is the right of the stronger to enforce his will on the weaker. And so they do that by lying, cheating, stealing, and so on. And I think Foucault's analysis of power, which is post-Nietzschean, was probably something that these people have actually read and largely agreed with, but they don't think that they don't want to come out right and admit that. They know that the truth, they think this is the actual truth, that's what life is. They think that truth is too dangerous to be shared with the masses, so they keep it to themselves and manipulate the shadows on the walls of Plato's cave. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think these people probably have been reading Foucault and drawing some very bad lessons from it.
Well, you know what's paradoxical, and I mentioned this in the article, that, you know, I said, you know, what if you do realize that Foucault is telling the truth? What do you do then? Well, there can't be truth in the Foucauldian universe. And that's hard for us to even say that there.
Yeah, that's like the Cretan liar's paradox, except this is the Foucauldian truth teller's paradox.
Yeah. So the minute that a Foucauldian claim, or a Nietzschean claim, and postmodernism itself, relativism, the minute it enters into the Socratic, meaning the minute it is put into the elenchus, which is the inquiry mode, and one looks at the claim to see if it's true. That looking at a claim to see if it's true using the mind and evidence is itself the opposite of Foucauldianism or Nietzscheanism, right? So the mode of life has to be one that's truthless, not because one is against truth or says this, but because it doesn't even come to one's mind to make judgments of truth. One is too busy making practical judgments of power to gain power, and using any kind of claim as merely a tool of manipulation and power. And the key there then is to never permit, you know, this to be looked at philosophically, this whole thing. So the political becomes everything. There is no room for speculative or contemplation or inquiry. It's not that it's censored or shunned. I mean, that's one way to do it. It's just that it becomes a kind of non-existing mode of life. That's the goal they have. They want to prevent the possibility of inquiry. Even bad inquiry they don't want. Like, they just don't want the idea that there's a realm of reality that one can engage where one examines reality under this transcendental called truth. I mean, if you think about it, somebody who is constantly tortured and abused is not thinking about the truth. Their leisure time is gone. They're simply doing everything they do to survive, right? It's like the drug addict who will say anything to get the money for the next crack high or something, right? They'll tell you anything. They're not even in the world of truth. They're simply in the world of manipulation. Don't you think that more and more of our culture and discourse is becoming not so much full of untruths and, you know, bad claims, but really even not even in the universe of making truth claims? It's simply just that's kind of what I'm getting at in the article. It's a kind of very low level existential situation we're in. And I've noticed this in microcosm, in different, you mentioned academia, the academic environment, in most places, and this is true of even in so-called Christian or Catholic environments, there's a veneer of, intellectual integrity and search for truth. And there's talk about this, but the actual like warp and woof of the experience is manipulative. You know what I mean? And so I think it's just becoming more and more like that. If you're able to detect manipulation and say that's manipulation as opposed to truth inquiry, you know, that's like kind of becoming more and more of a miracle. And they're doing their best to they're calling people who do that. They're simply deplatforming, canceling, destroying, killing, you know, in terms of livelihood and reputation and sometimes even physical life. And that's, of course, the earmark of totalitarianism, where the distinction between fact and fiction is gone. And the person for whom the distinction between fact and fiction no longer exists is the perfect citizen of the totalitarian regime. Here's a quiz. Who said that, Kevin?
Good question. Hannah Arendt?
Yes. All right. A+. Very good.
Good guess.
That was her. Yeah. She said that. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like, yeah, it sounds kind of like the analysis of the COVID scamdemic as mass formation psychosis.
Yes.
We've been hearing about. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good insight, because people who are in that psychotic state, they're not thinking, literally. They're not thinking. I mean, I think what I'm getting at is there's going to be a lot of words, a lot of discourse, but no actual thought, meaning that there's no actual words being said, judgments being made, claims being made that are anything other than for the purpose of manipulation, both on the speaker's part and the listener's part. I think that's what we're heading for and already in.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I could sense that really coming on post 9/11, once I read David Ray Griffin's analysis and got involved in the truth movement, I noticed that the argument was really very easy to win from the pro 9/11 truth side. And the deflections and obfuscations on the other side were, they ranged from bad to just completely pathetic. And people would just literally kind of say anything to avoid the argument. And pretty soon the word truth became pejorative. They started, right, you say, talking about truthiness. So I guess, you know, anybody who still is searching for truth is characterized by something called truthiness. And a person who wants the truth about things like 9/11 is a truther, which is bad because we don't like the truth. So, you know, I thought originally when the 9/11 truth movement sort of chose that name for itself, that it was a pretty good choice because, you know, who could be against the truth? Well, little did I realize the whole culture is against the truth. And so then it got worse. And I think with COVID, we really could see how they were consciously saying things not because they thought they were true, but because they thought that that would elicit the behavior that they wanted. You know, right. With 9/11, nobody really came out and admitted that. But with COVID, they did. Like, Fauci admitted that First, he said that masks don't work, not because they don't work, because he later changed his mind and said they do work. He said, I just told you that they don't work because I was trying to get you to lay off the masks so they could be saved for the first responders who need them. Oh, you were lying to us to manipulate whether or not we would use these masks. Okay, and then later, of course, he changed his mind. He said, well, actually, the cloth masks don't work, but now you should go out and buy some N95s because there are lots of them for sale, and maybe I have stock in the company or something. But, yeah, total manipulation. And likewise, the people who believed in the scamdemic sincerely, which is, of course, 99.9% of the people who were pushing the usual kinds of COVID measures, I think were pretty conscious of the fact that they were participating in this Foucault-like discourse system where the only issue was just trying to influence behavior to get people to do what they want them to do, namely to distance, to mask, to get vaccinated, and we'll just say whatever it takes to make that happen. And they pretty much just admitted that. And now with Russia versus Ukraine, it's gone really off the rails. If you read the mainstream media now about this, it's so obvious that there's zero concern for the truth about anything whatsoever. They just totally make stuff up. You know, it goes from, oh, well, Russia is losing to Russia's committing war crimes, and they make up the war crimes, and they make, you know, Putin's got cancer here, and it's totally make stuff up without the slightest concern for truth. And then, you know, I was listening to public radio a while back, and they had some expert on talking about how, well, it may not have actually been true that the heroes of Snake Island were actually heroic, or that the ghost fighter shot down Russian planes, but that doesn't matter because it encouraged the Ukrainians to fight harder. And so they're coming right out now and admitting that they don't even care at all about truth. Now, how could anybody believe a word of what they're getting out of the media and get all excited about Ukraine in this kind of situation? I mean, how stupid would you have to be? Well, about as stupid as, what, 70-80% of the people? I don't know.
Oh, yes. You know, it's hard. So when you believe something that makes you feel good to believe it, it makes you feel like, you know, this is Rene Girard, right? You're part of the righteous group. You have your scapegoat, right? You know, in the normal situation, they have to hide the innocence of the scapegoat, right? Because if he were innocent, it wouldn't work. You know, he has to be seen as guilty. The innocence is imputed to you because you're the one recognizing the guilt and you're against the evil and all that. And that gives you a sense of solidarity with others, and you're in reality and you're on the good side, and you have an identity and you have a purpose in life. You know, you have some drama in your life that used to be just mindless consumerism and hedonism and, you know, isolation. Now you've got, you know, these emotional things that are being fulfilled. But it seems to me that you really want to think that this fantasy that you're believing in is true. If you really didn't think it were true, I think it wouldn't work. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I think when they're pushing, you know, the Snake Island heroes or the ghost fighter kinds of stories, that the people who are pushing that, some of them know they're not true, but view them as Platonic noble lies. That is, they convince themselves right. that, well, something like this is true. You know, a bunch of fighters really shot down some Russian planes, so we might as well just say there was a ghost fighter. Or there have been some heroic Ukrainians, so let's just say that it happened at Snake Island, even though it didn't.
Well, that's true about the propagandists. I'm talking about now the receivers of the propaganda at this point, those not in the ruling class, and maybe those not even in the second tier, those maybe in the third tier of people. Not the kind of low level ruling class, but just the masses, let's say. I think the idea here is to get people into a situation where they really wouldn't change their viewpoint even if they knew it were untrue. So I just
that's like Fran Schur, the 9/11 psychologist, told us about that person she spoke to who said, I wouldn't believe this stuff you're telling me about 9/11, even if it were true.
Yes. And I think that's it. And I think it's happening. In other words, the question of whether or not the things you claim to think are true, the question is not important anymore. It's simply whether or not me saying these things and believing them, believe in scare quotes, does the work I want it to do for me. But the paradox of this is it only will – this is what I'm trying to figure out here. The paradox is it really can't do the work unless you think it's true to some extent, because you know what I mean? I don't think it could be that you really don't think it's true. I don't think it's going to have the same emotional, reputational, career, economic, social goods. It's not going to have those benefits. But I wonder if people are at I wrote this about in another article on my Substack. I wonder if people are getting to the point now, and this sounds like Orwell, where they're actually both knowing and not knowing it's true. And I think people are becoming used to that state. And that to me sounds like satanic, occult witchcraft, where you get somebody in a state where they're, you know, their yes is not yes and their no is not no. They're in between. That to me just seems so degrading and inhuman. You know, it's one thing to be a liar, know you're lying, but it's another thing to kind of be a liar to yourself and to others and kind of know and not know it. I think I got this idea from Tom Breidenbach, you know, his book on 9/11, because he mentioned that the way that satanic liturgy works, like a black mass, you know, done as a false flag, is to have you, is to lie to you and to have you believe it, but also to give enough evidence that it's a lie, but not enough so that it's too obvious, but enough so that you kind of know in the back of your mind that what you're worshiping and the narrative you're believing in is if you just looked into it, it would probably fall, but you don't look into it, right? And so that kind of gray area is exactly where the devil wants people, right?
You know, that reminds me of my colleagues at the University of Wisconsin that I spoke with about 9/11 before I became well-known in that field. And the response I got from all of them was one version or another of, well, you know, Kevin, you might be right about this, but I don't want to look into it because it could be true.
Yeah. And so it's a state where people don't actually believe what they believe. And that's really pretty scary. If you think about it, they kind of believe what they believe, but they don't. I mean, I'm just thinking that this was perfect with, and I think this was deliberate, you know, the masks especially, and there's been some spoofs on this by like Babylon Bee, you know, they had like Mask Addict Anonymous and kind of person admits like, yeah, I know these don't work, but but they work. You know, they do. You know, and I don't know. I'm just thinking the psychological effect of that is really dangerous. And that seems to be where the propaganda is going. And maybe this is the, you know, the final kind of state of the Foucauldian thing. You know, you can't get someone. You can't tyrannize someone to get them to do your will if they think that they're doing only your will. Who wants to do that, right? Who wants to actually, you know, be enslaved to another, and it doesn't do you any good? You know, Aristotle says everything we do is under the guise of the good, and it's the problem is that we have the apparent good and the real good, and we tend to we choose the apparent good, the good that seems good to us, but we're still doing it as if it were good. We just make a mistake. And that mistake could be more or less culpable, but we're never actually choosing to do what we do or believe what we believe. Well, we're not choosing to do what we do because we think it's evil for us in every way that'll harm us. And we're never choosing to believe something because we think it's false. You know, it seems to go against like the natural law. But maybe what's happening now is, with the tyranny, we kind of know that we're really doing the will of Fauci and Gates or some nefarious group or energy. I'm talking about the people under the spell here. We kind of know that we're not really being helped by these people. They don't have our best interests in mind. How could you think otherwise? I mean, how could you really think they love us? But at the same time, we still want to obey them and think and believe what they say because of some benefit it gives to us. But I think we kind of know in the back of our minds that it's ultimately not beneficial. And that, you know what that sounds like to me? It sounds like damnation.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, the church teaches on hell that nobody goes there unless they choose to. So in other words, when you die, if you die in a state of enmity with God, it means that you know that choosing choosing against God is not going to make you happy, and yet you do it anyway because what you want more than your happiness is to be able to say no to God. And to just say that you're right to yourself and maybe to all the other people in hell, even if that means misery. And that's what hell is. It's a kind of perpetual, relentless refusal of the good, because there's something you want more than the good, if that's even possible. You want your own will. You want the ability to be able to will whatever you do will. And if that means willing against God and reality and your own happiness, so be it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think what's happening now since the scandemic Ukraine is a kind of like conditioning people to behave this way or to have this mindset? You know, that's what I'm wondering.
Yes, I do think so. You know, talking about what's good for us, all of these people who are wildly cheering the war in Ukraine and demanding more support for Ukraine, supposedly. It's really a NATO versus Russia war, and Ukraine is just the pawn. But sure, the way it's presented, of course, is the heroic underdog Ukrainians are the guys that we should be supporting. So they've got a lot of people, blue checks on Twitter and people like that, all screaming for blood, for Russian blood, and let's declare a no-fly zone and start shooting down Russian planes. And Biden says, well, that means World War III. All these people are calling for World War III. Now, do they realize what they're calling for? Do they really realize, is that going to be good for them when the nukes start flying and the EMP pulse takes out the power for the next 10 years and, according to projections, 97-98% of the population dies? Is that going to be good for you? I don't think so. But they're clamoring for something that's kind of the worst possible thing for them and everybody else around them. And so, yeah, obviously they've got their good and their not so good, their value system totally mixed up and discombobulated. And yeah, I think that's probably intentional because when you get people in that state, they're more manipulable. You know, in the Quran, God says that it can be that something, you know, seems good to you, but it's not. And it can be that something that's good for you, you know, you don't realize it. This is discussed with, in terms of fasting. You know, we just finished the Ramadan fast. And so a lot of people, of course, you say, yeah, you should go for a whole month, not even touching any food or not even a drop of water from the first light of dawn until sundown. That sounds like, oh, that's not good for me. Well, actually, it is good for you spiritually and even physically. And now they're starting to learn that fasting is really good for you physically. Science is figuring that out. So it turns out that Allah was right about that and so many other things. So, yeah, we don't always know what's good for us, but now we're ruled by these demonic types who systematically obscure what's good for us and try to get us going after the bad. And that's actually the shaitan's audubillah role. The devil's role in creation is to tempt people to try to turn them against God, as you described. And in the Islamic view, life is a test to see if we can not fall for that and indeed follow God's teaching and do what is really good for us, which is what God wants for us. And I think that's actually pretty close to the Christian worldview too.
Yes, it is. And the mystery, though, is why anyone would choose what's bad for them. I mean, Plato couldn't handle that. And so he said that anytime we choose something that actually damages us, hurts us, is because we don't have knowledge. If we had the knowledge of, let's say, justice, you know this, right? If we knew the form of justice, and we really knew it, you know, not just an intellectual, but a holistic kind of heartfelt, deep, you know, penetrating wisdom about what justice is, a kind of co-natural, they call it, knowledge, experiential even, deep, almost like you become one with it. You would never act unjustly, because in doing so, you'd be acting against yourself, and we don't do that. Like, we're kind of programmed not to do that. And so he thought it was a matter of knowledge. I'm not so sure. Aristotle introduced the idea of a kind of weakness of prohairesis, is the Greek for choice. He didn't have a word for the will, really. Voluntas in Latin. I forgot the Greek. What's prohairesis is the choice. But he did think that we could act against what we know. And Plato would just say, well, that just means you didn't know it, you know? So you have this debate back and forth. But it seems to me that what the devil wants is not just to cause you to harm yourself and to cause pain and misery and doubt, despair, but he wants you to be guilty. He wants you to do this knowingly, choose the evil knowingly, even knowing where it's going to land you. You know, because, I mean, if you think about, the devil had perfect intellect, according to the church, like a perfect created intellect. He couldn't be tempted by passions or emotions or lack of knowledge. And his knowledge was perfect in the sense that in the very act of an angel, he sees all the possible consequences of the act up unto eternity. And so he's fully in his aware. And so the mystery is why this angel, knowing that he would end up losing the war that he was going to engage in and end up in a state of misery, separate from God, why he would still choose it. And again, it has to be because one just simply wants what one wants, whatever that is, more than one wants what's actually good. In wanting what's actually good, you have to admit that your goodness is not under your control. You have to receive it from another, right? You're dependent in some way on your unhappiness. In other words, you're not self-sufficient to make yourself happy. And for whatever reason, there's something in us that balks at that. It's called original sin in the Christian tradition. That we have a tendency to want to be independent, like God is, right? So God is not dependent. His happiness is by his very existence. He is happiness. So he doesn't depend on anything other. Well, all creatures are dependent, and that's just our lot. And our happiness is to accept that dependence and then live a life of religion, which is reconnect, religio, in humility and in independence and surrender, which of course makes you vulnerable. What if you're surrendering to something that could hurt you? Well, if you're perfectly vulnerable, then you're going to be hurt. So maybe we simultaneously are doubtful about this surrender because we don't know what we're surrendering to. So we want to have a bulwark in ourselves so we can have control, right? We can have self-sufficiency. That seems to be what the culture is trying to tell us. And so you put all that together and you have people who are very intent on preserving their personal power, because if they don't, someone else will get them. That sounds like Hobbes' war against, all against all, right? So we have to preserve this self-protection and power. And maybe that's, part of the reason why people are now, choosing to believe lies and to believe lies that are harmful, if it means that they can still have a sense of their own independence, autonomy, or power. And they want that more than anything. And if that's what you want more than anything else, well, you'll have that for eternity. You'll have, you'll be dependent on yourself only. You'll have no one to answer for, but you'll be entirely alone, isolated, and in a way spiritually buried alive. But at least you have your, at least you could say, my will be done. Not thy will be done. My will be done. Even if that will is to be spiritually buried alive for eternity. So this sounds pretty scary and horrific, but honestly, when I look around and see all the people giving into the lies so easily, even the ones who should know better, right? Even the ones who are trained in philosophy, theology, spirituality, the leaders of religion, I'm seeing such a treachery, a mass treachery against truth that I just, it just makes me really wonder how many people are going to make it. Am I going to make it? I mean, it really is bracing, isn't it, Kevin?
It kind of feels like the end times.
I thought 9/11 was the worst when I started to see it happening there, right? I mean, and so did you, but did you ever imagine it would get to this state?
No, I'm kind of, you know, expected, I guess 9/11 conditioned me to imagine that it would continue in that vein, that it would be all, you know, this war against Islam would go on forever, which of course was the purpose of 9/11. They wanted a sort of 100 years or who knows, maybe 1,000 years war on Islam, primarily to benefit Israel, but also to bring in the kind of totalitarian power behind these folks that did it. So I kind of thought it would keep going in that vein. And if there were going to be another bigger war, it would probably be them going after Iran, which is really the biggest thorn in the side of Israel and in some ways of the empire itself. I didn't think it would be Russia because it seemed that Russia's policy, like China's, was patience and so on. And so I didn't see that coming. And I didn't see the COVID thing coming either, I have to admit. I mean, you know, we talk about all of these possibilities. There are all sorts of catastrophes that could hit. And, yeah, we've talked a little bit about that in the past. Before COVID hit, there could be a pandemic or even a fake pandemic, like all of these other possibilities. But, no, I certainly wouldn't have put that at the top of what I imagined would be coming. So, yeah, it kind of blindsided me, too, and everybody else, I guess, pretty much.
Yeah.
And you know, when you talk about that my will be done rather than thy will be done being the kind of the damned person's motto, that fits in very much with the kind of, you know, primordial scene in the Quran where God creates Adam and the devil objects and says refuses to bow down. God orders all of the angels to bow down before Adam and the devil, who actually isn't an angel, he's a jinn, but it's a similar kind of being, but not as high as the angels. He refuses to bow down, and the God says, well, you know, what's wrong with you? And he says, I'm better than him. You know, and he made me out of fire, and you made him out of just clay or mud. And so then God sends and damns him. And the devil says, can you give me a reprieve till the judgment day so I can try to beguile these humans that I hate so much? And God says, yeah, that's your job. So he's part of the test. And all of this is a big test. And of course, in Islam, we say there's no, you know, get out of jail free card or anything. It's totally up to each one of us to die with our good deeds outweighing our sins.
Right.
And then we're in paradise. And if not, then not. It's hellfire. So that's kind of that Islamic worldview, but it's pretty similar to what you were saying in terms of the devil's prime defect and the defect of the people who follow him is this kind of egotism where it's, I'm better than him. You know, it's me, me, me. And I think that actually represents something in creation. When God created this creation and gave it absolute freedom, you know, every subatomic particle has a little bit of freedom. And as they group together and form more complex things, the level of freedom rises. You get up to humans. There's a really intense level of freedom as our brains are, you know, firing on the quantum edge a zillion times a second. So we have vast amounts of freedom. And that includes the freedom to choose evil. And so this test is a test as creation, you know, as all of creation choosing God and submission to God or Islam, or is it choosing evil, which is rebellion against God? And but you know, to make it a good test, creation has to have that selfishness, right? Everything in creation has this element of me, me, me. You know, every creature wants to increase and flourish and gain pleasure and power, and me, me, me has a sense of itself as opposed to the non-self, and it favors the self. And so that becomes the equivalent, I guess, what you would call original sin. And that, you know, we seem to be in a time right now where the whole human species is really radically being misled by these satanic forces.
Yeah, and it must be for the good. I mean, to me, the good of all this is you're seeing who exactly is, you know, is really a non-Foucauldian. Now, getting back to Foucault, I mean, I think what Foucault was presenting was the culture and philosophy of hell, you know, which is the most sacred act we can do is speech. I mean, for Christianity, God became the word, the logos. It means word. We have sacred scripture, you know, you have the Quran. Speech is a kind of divine. It's only humans can speak. Animals can't. It's a divine participation speech. And it's the primary instrument of love is speech, I think. I mean, deeds are a kind of speech too, gestures and bodily expressions. I mean, you know, in other words, communication rationally of reality, the highest reality, can only be done through speech. From human to human, God can do this without speech through mystical enlightenment. But for humans, it's speech, and so the sacredness of language, I think, is the thing being attacked the most in the Foucauldian system. And it seems to me that's just happening everywhere. The sacredness of the word. So people are being habituated to use their speech making power as a instrument of egocentric vampiric power, and it's we're being conditioned from the top down on this, but we're seeing how many people are okay with this, who maybe were closet Foucauldians, you know, before, and maybe they're given more they're now being given kind of carte blanche to be able to, you know, live out their Foucauldian fantasies. And I think maybe to me it's a great sifting, and let's say you know, the darkness is coming to light. Just how many people are really you know, unwilling to be in the truth when it comes down to it, you know. And it's scary because each of us could be tempted and fail. You know, the Our Father prayer says, lead us not into temptation. We pray that every day, many times a day, because we don't want to be tested and fail. But it looks to me that God is saying, nope, it's time for the testing. Your life is a test, no matter what, but now it's intense. Okay. The fact that your life is a test is, becoming more real, you might say, what it's happening on the macrocosm. And to me, I'm both accepting of this with gratitude, because it makes the drama more apparent and the stakes more real. And, you know, who wants a life of just mindless pleasure seeking and where religion is really not that important because everything's fine? I mean, you really don't want that. It's dangerous. On the other hand, obviously it's scary, and it makes every minute more sacred. It seems like time is speeding up too. So you mentioned in the end times. I really do think that. I mean, if this isn't the end times, I don't know how long it's going to go, but if this isn't, what would be, you know?
Yeah. How much worse could it get to be more end timesish than this? Well, right. You mentioned that it seems like a lot of people are closet Foucauldians, but there are also those who are pushing back from all of these different kinds of angles. Yeah. And we're being lumped together now. You know, we used to be lumped as conspiracy theorists and so on. And now they're lumping us as the new right, which is kind of weird. You know, right. For most of my life, I thought I was a little leaning more on the left than the right if I had to pick. But now everybody who's awake is the new right. There was just this Vanity Fair piece that I sent you the link.
Yeah,
Yeah, about this. It's basically, it's intended to be a hit piece against these people, and the people that the hit piece is targeting, quote, share a basic worldview that individualist liberal ideology, increasingly bureaucratic governments, and big tech are all combining into a world that is at once tyrannical, chaotic, and devoid of the systems of value and morality that give human life richness and meaning. As Blake Masters recently put it, a dystopian hell world. I guess I'm one of the people that sort of take that.
I agree. Yeah, you're a new rightist if you believe every word of man insofar as man is ruling over you. If you don't believe everything that's told to you by authority. I thought that was the left. Wasn't that the left?
Yeah, they've flipped, haven't they?
Talk about Orwellian, right? I thought the authoritarian personality, you know, Horkheimer and all this stuff. I thought the left was the one who doubted narratives. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what, what's his name? Leotard, right? Mm-hmm. Postmodern condition. There are no more meta narratives, right? The time of meta narratives are over. You know, and only what? 100 years, not even. No, he wrote that in the 60s. Oh, in only 80 years or so, we now have the opposite, that there's only meta-narratives and there's only one. And if you question it, you're a truther and therefore on the new right, and you're a domestic terrorist and you're a disinformation spreader. And you're also a plague on the new mystical body of man. Well, that's what Robert Hugh Benson said in his book written in the early 1900s called Lord of the World. It's his book on the Antichrist. And he envisioned, this cancerous limb on the mystical body of man. And he really predicted exactly what you're talking about, us. We're the cancer. And how do you get rid of cancer, Kevin? Well, you remove the limb or chemotherapy, and that's how it ended his book. Mass murder of every single person who didn't bow down to Feldenstein, I think was the name of the Antichrist, which is interesting.
I should read that.
Felsenberg. Oh, it's worth reading. Yeah, Robert Hugh Benson, Lord of the World. It's really prescient, amazingly. Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like a dystopian classic. Well, it is getting, we're in weird times when if you're a peacenik and a civil liberties advocate, you're a radical right-wing extremist. Where did that come from?
Yeah, I just saw your piece on that. Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah, they've really messed with our minds, messed with our categories. But we are pushing back. And the cool thing about this Vanity Fair piece inside the new right is that it kind of shows that our way of thinking seems to be becoming trendy among younger people.
Yes.
So, hey, that's cool. Maybe we'll live long enough to be cool again.
Well, that might be something to be not so celebrated, right? Because are they into this stuff because it's cool and hip and different and anti-establishment, or because it's true? And do they know it to be true? If the motivation for liking this new counterculture is because of some avant-garde, desire to be avant-garde. I mean, that's not going to help things,
Yeah. And that's one of the issues with Alexander Dugin. I have had Charles Upton on the show talking about that. He wrote a great critique of Alexander Dugin, who's pretty popular in some of these new right circles. And, yeah, of course, now he's the guru of Putin's war, according to the establishment. And I met him in Tehran, and he seems like a nice enough guy. And we shared stories of how both of us were massively influenced by René Guénon and the traditionalist movement. And so I like him personally. However, as Charles Upton points out, he's got a kind of a Heideggerian background. He's a little bit on the postmodernist side himself. And so some of that has been kind of scary and dubious. Apparently he was in some group when he was young that had satanic overtones and stuff. So there's an element of where he's coming from that seems to be kind of contaminated with this whole sort of postmodern quasi satanic thing. And Upton's very, very worried about that. And a lot of this new right seems to similarly have a tinge of that they haven't quite gotten past the whole Nietzschean.
Well, that's Foucauldian. Back to Foucault.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if the new right and the Duganites are all about, you know, taking back power, or using their highfalutin, philosophy and theology for the sake of manipulating the discourse for the truth, for God, I mean, that's still Foucauldian, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the paradox here is true power is for Christianity, the crucifixion, the cross. True power is love. Love your enemies. I mean, it is true power. It's not just rhetoric here, but it's the paradoxical power of, and it doesn't mean there isn't a such thing as a just war. It doesn't mean you don't critique your enemies. It doesn't mean you don't fight. It just means that kind of idea that what matters really in the end is your own power, or the power, the dominating power of your religion, your paradigm. It can't be domination. It's surrender to reality. I mean, is what religion's all about. And so how do you get people to surrender to reality? Well, you can't do it by force. You can't do it by manipulation. It has to be through an encounter with the reality, and from you becoming that reality that they encounter. So yeah, I'm hesitant to, I'm a little nervous too. Although I'm happy that there's at least an intellectual, reaction and rebellion against, you know, these ideologies. But it's very easy to morph into the mirror image of the thing you hate. Don't you think? I mean, that's a danger.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It seems to me that the new right, which really they all look back to Guénon just like I do, like Dugin does, but they seem to miss the fact that Guénon surrendered to God. He did it through Islam because he saw that as the best preserved revelation. He turned against all this manipulation that came out of Freemasonry after he'd been in Freemasonry, and he just surrendered to God. He wrote the books of truth as he saw it, and then he went to Cairo and lived in a very modest kind of neighborhood as a pious Muslim among pious Muslims and worshiped God for the rest of his life. And some of these people are following, I mean, maybe Julius Evola, who wants to politicize things, which inevitably leads to getting away from truth and returning to the Foucauldian. But.
Yeah, it's Nietzschean religion, Nietzschean theism, you know, we got to be careful of that.
And we sure do. And that's a good place to leave it because we hit the end of the hour. The bumper music is playing. So it's time to say thank you, Thaddeus Kaczynski, for all of your great work at your Substack, which is thaddeuskaczynski.substack.com.
Yes. Thanks, Kevin. Very, very fun to talk to you.
Okay. Likewise. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thaddeus Kaczynski back in the next hour with Lynn Dim. This is Kevin Barrett of TrueJihad.com.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's Ivan Franklin. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for free association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, welcome back to the second hour of tonight's Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking to a whole lot of the smartest people who have the guts and the heart to say exactly what they think and cut through the BS that is descending on us like a miasma of putrid smog. It's getting thicker all the time. You need a knife to cut through it these days. So one of my favorite literary intellectuals out there, who's also a very good writer and photographer, is Mr. Lin Din. He was on the upswing in career-wise in the literati circuit here in the United States until he started telling too much truth about various things such as 9/11. And next thing you know, he's been in exile, roaming all over the world. He's currently in Vung Tau, Vietnam, where he hangs out at the Ca Dao Cafe. Apologize for my terrible Vietnamese pronunciation. He got there, I guess, from Namibia. And before Namibia, there were, well, a string of places. He's been traveling all over the world during the COVID scandemic and got back just when Putin ended it by invading Ukraine. He's been to Laos, Cairo, Alexandria, Aswan, Tirana, Cape Town, Klaus, Swakopmund, Rehoboth, Windhoek. I can't even pronounce these towns he's been in, but he's back in Vietnam now and in a time zone where we can talk to him on this show. So, hey, welcome. Lin Din, good to have you back.
Hey, Kevin. Great to talk to you again, man.
Yeah, hey, you're sounding good, and so is your internet connection.
Cool. I hope there's no problem. I'm in an alley. I'm at the cafe right now, so you might hear some motorbikes in the background every now and then, but I should be okay.
Cool. That's actually the cafe that you wrote about in the latest article.
Yeah.
And took a picture of yourself. In fact, I have that picture up at the radio blog, and people can look at it by going to truthjihad.com. Click on the radio show link and find the entry for this show. You'll see Lynn sitting at the – is it the Ca Dao Cafe?
There's actually two different D's in Vietnamese, so it's actually the Ca Dao.
Ca Dao.
It's a Z, yeah.
Okay. So well, it looks like a great
table,
place.
Yeah.
I wish I could join you at the table. It looks pretty nice.
There's quite a few mosquitoes here, but, otherwise it's fine. It's a great place to sit.
Well, that's amazing. So you've got the mosquitoes instead of me. That's a switch. Like here in the swamplands of the Wisconsin River Country, we typically have the worst clouds of mosquitoes in creation. But right now they haven't come out yet. So I've got one less thing to complain about. And, you know, now that you're on the show, I have one less thing to complain about too, Lynn, because it's been hard to get in touch with you between the kinds of places you've been staying and your lousy time zone for this show. It's been a while since you've been on. So you have a lot to say, I guess, about both where you've been and your, as discussed to this, the rest of us, about the COVID scamdemic and the Ukraine insane is what Thaddeus Kaczynski called it. Yeah.
So there's a lot to talk about. Yeah. And things are getting very urgent, man.
Yeah. You know, Thaddeus and I were talking about how all of the blue check people who are living in the matrix, that is the majority of the people who are, you know, sitting around on social media commenting on things, seem like they're all screaming for Armageddon, like, hey, give us a no-fly zone. And the media and the government here in the U.S. seem to be responding affirmatively. Just in the last day, we had the media tell us that the U.S. helped sink the Russian flagship and that the U.S. is helping Ukraine kill Russian generals. They're just begging Russia to take out an American ship and kill some American generals. Please help us start World War. Everybody's begging for World War III. Do they even understand what's going to happen when that breaks out?
Kevin, I think the boredom in the West is so great. You know, the tedium and just the mind-numbing lifestyle is so bad that they would rather just die, you know, but they want something exciting to happen just for maybe, half a day before they die. Something great to watch on TV and then maybe to see out the window and then they're gone. You know, anything but the life they're living, man. It's unbearable.
Oh, man. Well, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it.
No, I'm not wishing it for myself. I'm saying people, people in like, the USA, the great USA.
I know. So I'm talking to them when I say that. They must be infested with the Freudian thanatos, the death wish that Sigmund Freud said is causes so much of our problem. He got very metaphysical at a certain point, you know, got past his pee-pee caca fixation and got kind of metaphysical.
Yeah.
And yeah, you see a death wish sometimes, and it's—I mean, anybody who's like calling for a no-fly zone obviously has a very serious death wish.
Well, one of my readers sent me a message and said that he was drunk all the time in one of the Midwest states, and he thought that he couldn't go on like that, so he had to join the army. And within 6 months, he was in Afghanistan, and he said it was the best time of his life. You know,
sobered him up, huh?
Yeah, I mean, and now that he's back, he's like, you know, dying of boredom. I mean, he would go to like Walmart just to see people.
You know, you must be pretty bored if you're going to Walmart to see people for kicks. Because I mean, well, they're not
you must
the most
be pretty
aesthetically.
Bored to go to Afghanistan for excitement, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of got an honorable pedigree because there's a whole history of people, including literary figures like Hemingway, who went to war and had the time of their lives. As scary and horrible as it was, it's still the time of their lives. They come back in peacetime, and life is boring. Part of the problem there, as Colin Wilson wrote some pretty good books about this. I mean, he's a kind of a pop philosopher. A lot of people write him off as a crank, but I think he was onto certain things. He wrote a book called Poetry and Mysticism, where he's talked about how people need to get back in touch with the mystical way of seeing reality. The mystical way is when you strip all the veils of the superficial materialistic perception away and you actually see what's in front of you. And some people, this happens when they take psychedelics too. You're overwhelmed with the glorious magnificence of every little speck of creation. You know, the grain of sand is infinite, and that perception means you don't need to go off to war and experience death and blood and male buddy bonding with the guys who are experiencing death and blood to feel good about life. You're like blown away by the beauty of life and grateful to the creator of it, and you're good. But I think that the culture now doesn't have much any of that.
Well, guys like Hemingway and Orwell, they went to war under a kind of idealism. You know, they were motivated by something very coherent. But a lot of Americans, they go to war over really nothing. I mean, they're fighting for Jews, man. They're fighting, dining for Jews. I mean, they don't even know where they're going. So it's a whole different ballgame. You know what I'm saying? They're fleeing from something.
So let's talk about that, because here at Truth Jihad Radio, we go exactly to the place that you're not supposed to go. So like with the 9/11 wars, if you said, you know, this is going into Iraq especially, but even to some extent Afghanistan and then Syria and Libya and so on, and destroying Somalia and destroying Sudan and just, you know, destroying Lebanon, all of this is fighting for Jews. You wouldn't be entirely wrong, because you're fighting for the Jewish state, and the Jewish state is supported by an awful lot of ethnocentric and some of them very, very wealthy and powerful Jewish people all over the world, especially here in the United States, New York, D.C., Los Angeles, and other places. So if you said that, you know, then I'd say you're not entirely wrong. But with the Ukraine thing, it's, you know, it's not as obvious that there's any particular, you know, Zionist, Israeli, or ethnically Jewish angle too. I mean, yes, angles, but is that what it's really primarily about, or is it more primarily about kind of a liberal, oligarchical, you know, neoliberal empire that's trying to swallow up the world? And yeah, maybe very wealthy Jewish people are overrepresented among the oligarchy of that empire, but that's not all it is. It's really more of an oligarchy than just a bunch of Jews, isn't it?
But Kevin, let's slow down and look at the Ukraine situation. Okay, you have this Zelensky guy who's Jewish, right? And the guy behind him, Kolomoisky, who is also Jewish and an oligarch, who has four citizenships, okay, four passports, okay? So Zelensky was propped up by this Kolomoisky. You know, Kolomoisky groomed the Ukrainian people to think of this guy as a president through a TV show, all right? And then he created a political party to, you know, to prepare him for the presidency. So he's basically a fiction, you know, for the Ukrainian people. You know, he's not a real president. He's a guy.
He's a reality show president.
With his penis, man. You know, I mean, I hope everyone knows that by now. You know, and he made fun of the Cossacks with this sort of village people version of, you know, of the Cossacks. I mean, Jews hate Slavs, man. And Zelensky's and Kolomoisky, they hate Slavs. So they'd love to see Russians and Ukrainians killing each other. All right, so it is a Jewish thing, and you have Victoria Nuland, whose grandfather was from Odessa, so she's still bitter about the fact that her granddaddy had to be kicked out of Ukraine, and nearly drove her father crazy. Okay, so there's a Jewish angle all over the place, and the defense minister is Reznikov, another Jew, and you know the Jews are quite proud of this angle. I mean, they're celebrating it. You know, they say this is a war of Jewish Ukraine versus the new Hitler. So they're celebrating it. It's out in the open. And, you know, and if you want to get a little bit more speculative, you can say Khazaria. Khazaria was this Jewish empire right where Ukraine is now. And Khazaria was this Jewish empire that was destroyed by the Russians. Okay, so maybe there's some, you know, atavistic revenge here. You know, there's a lot of angles. The Jewish angles are all over this war. But basically, Jews love to see white people killing each other. And, you know, white people are so happy to oblige them, you know, including Americans who go to war to kill, you know, well, not just other white people, but, you know, World War II. All right, so the Jewish angle is very important to examine. And hardly anybody's talking about it except, you know, nutcases like us.
Yeah, no, I agree that those are legitimate angles. And it's interesting also that this kind of neocon and Jewish oligarch alliance that's got a lot of influence in Ukraine is allying with these neo-Nazis from Galicia. And what do they have in common? They all hate Slavs. As you said, some of these Jews hate Slavs because of the pogroms and the whole history there when they were in the Pale of Settlement, which is in what's now Ukraine, and going back then to the Russians and the Slavs defeating Khazaria, as you said. So, yeah, there may be these ancient tribal hatreds, but it's interesting. It's driven these Jews into a kind of alliance with Nazis. These Galicia Nazis who were recruited by the CIA after World War II and weaponized against the Soviet Union and were continued to be maintained as potential weapons against Russia. And then they were unleashed in 2014. So absolutely, these kinds of ethnic factors are there. But in the big picture, I still see this thing as more an attempt to lure the Russian bear into a trap in order to take out one of these three pillars of the emerging multipolar world. And yeah, maybe they chose Russia partly because of these ethnic hatreds. But on the other hand, if it was Jews and Zionists calling the shots, wouldn't they have gone after Iran first? I mean, they hate Iran a lot more than they hate Russia. These Jews and Zionists actually have a lot of influence in Russia. So to me, it's not so obvious that at the, you know, the highest level, this is really about Jews or Zionism.
But here's another interesting a consideration. Okay, they are hurting the West by going to war against Russia. Okay, so because of the wheat production that is prevented from reaching the world market, you know, from Russia and Ukraine, there is a food shortage on the horizon. But the West is also hurting its own citizens. You know, in the United States, you have the killing of chickens, turkeys, pigs, fish, and even deer. Okay, so they starve. You know, so they starving their own people. I mean, they blaming the food shortages on Putin's war, but they're not doing anything to help themselves. So that's the real hidden agenda. I mean, with the vaccines, they have already killed a lot of their own people, and many more people will die. And now they're causing a food crisis. Okay, so this is very intentional. So, you know, they're not just going to war against Putin, they're going to war against themselves. I mean, well, their own citizens. Okay, so there's a depopulation agenda that should be looked at very soberly. And, you know, we got to figure this out, man. I mean, because they're not helping themselves at all. They're preventing food from being grown, and they're killing off a lot of their own food sources. So what's up with all that?
Yeah, one of the stories that I think we covered this last week on False Flag Weekly News, I think we talked about it a little bit, was the series of fires that broke out and plane crashes into food processing facilities. Within a couple of days, apparently, there were single-engine planes that dove into two of America's major food processing facilities. Now, I guess, you know, three times would be a conspiracy. Twice might still be coincidence, but that's still quite a coincidence, along with this long list of mysterious fires breaking out in the food processing facilities. It does make you wonder. On the other hand, there's always a sort of a hysteria about this sort of thing that arises and leads people to connect too many dots. But I don't think we should discount the possibility that there is some kind of depopulation agenda going on. The Malthusians in high places, including our friends Bill Gates and these other well-known Malthusian types, and depopulationists may actually be right that there's a problem with the level of human population that we have right now in terms of what it's doing to the ecosystem and where that will take us in the future. So certainly they think they're right. And if you were in that position and you were drunk on your own power, you know, you might take it on yourself to try to do something about it. And of course, that is, you know, it's legitimate speculation about where COVID came from. Could vaccines have some connection to this? Are they targeting reproductive systems? There are a lot of women who had stillbirths, perhaps connected to the vaccines and also to COVID itself. You know, that spike protein may be messing with us, and whether you get it from the disease or from the vaccine. And yeah, I think that stuff has to be talked about, but that's almost as taboo. In fact, it's probably about equally taboo as talking about Jewish connections to anything negative.
But Kevin, they've been talking about reducing the world population openly for decades. So it's not that taboo to them. It's just that their solutions don't include them. You know, they include us. You know, they want to kill us off. You know, they're not killing themselves off. I bet you don't even know how many people live in Vietnam, Kevin. Take a guess.
How many people what?
How many are the population of Vietnam?
Vietnam, boy, let me guess. I would guess 50 million.
100 million, man.
Whoa.
So see, okay. I mean, there is a population problem, But the way to solve it is, their way to solve it is to kill you and me and our children, okay? And who are they to decide, okay? So Vietnam is very overpopulated. But here's something else to consider. If you take China, India, and Southeast Asia, okay, more people live in that area alone than outside of it, okay? So this, where I am sitting right now, is the most fertile, the most conducive to human growth. I mean,
it's mostly rice, isn't it? Like really intensive rice cultivation?
And everything else, you know, because you can grow stuff year-round. Okay, yeah, it is rice, but, you know, Vietnamese eat everything, man. I mean, you know, your Vietnamese dish comes with all kinds of mint leaves, you know, wild, you know, like, you know, things that people don't eat anywhere else. You know, freshly picked all kinds of herbs and leaves, okay? So, you know, the competition for food is fierce here, all right? And that's why they eat everything. So, you know, you can eat innards and pig's brains and duck embryos and whatever, you know, wild rats and whatever. But, you know, most Vietnamese like to eat beef and chicken and seafood and shrimp, you know what I mean? So they like to eat the good stuff too. So what I'm trying to get at is that the resourcefulness of people here, I mean, they have to build up this openness to eating everything because the competition for food was so fierce. You know, it's been this way forever. So what I'm trying to get is moving forward, okay? What are people in the West going to do? Are they going to learn to have to adapt some of these practices or revert to older practices that they already had before? You know, and I'm not talking about, you know, like the, you know, suggestions from the top that people should eat more bugs and et cetera, okay, and fake beef and all that, all right? But
well, that's part of the Great Reset, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they've been talking openly. Like beef is like evil. You know, lamb is evil.
You will own nothing, eat bugs, and be happy.
Right, but I'm saying that, you know, well, Vietnamese don't really eat bugs, but they eat just about everything else. But they also love to eat beef. They eat a lot of beef here. What I'm trying to get is that, you know, moving forward, I mean, how are people going to survive this planned starvation? Okay, I'm talking about people in the West now. How are they going to survive this planned starvation? Supermarkets running out of food. Okay, so there's a lot of chatter online about growing your own food and raising your own chicken, but they are preventing that too. In Vũng Tàu, a city of 500,000 people, I can hear a rooster crowing every morning because people raise chickens right in the city. It's not a problem. Okay, so, but why are they preventing people in the West from doing that?
You can't. Well, people are starting to do that more here, but nowhere near at the level they would need to really feed themselves.
Living in a smaller town, right?
Well, yeah, but even in the cities, there are some people, it's kind of a hobbyist thing, and it's still a small minority of people. But and they don't use roosters because the roosters wake up the neighbors and piss everybody off. But like in Madison, Wisconsin, there are people who have these backyard little chicken things attached to their houses now. It's become a bit of a thing. I mean, it's going to have to become a lot more of a thing if it's going to contribute anything substantial to the food supply, of course.
Yeah, but at least you can save your own yourself, you know, by growing your own vegetables. By, you know, you don't really need that much land to supplement, you know, your food intake. So, you know, I'm talking about resourcefulness. We're getting back to that now.
Well, I do that here. I've got the equivalent of maybe 40 or 50 4x4 raised beds, some of it in railroad ties and some of it in giant tractor tires full of compost. And I grow all kinds of stuff and specialize in greens, which we freeze and keep all winter, and salads, but other stuff too.
But the first step is to realize your government is trying to kill you. You know, I mean, I think people should really need to be reminded of that all the time. Your government is trying to kill you. I don't think that's an extreme thing to say. I mean,
well, part of it is trying to help you, like Reagan said, the most dangerous words, and then part of it is trying to kill you. And that is kind of it messes with your mind. You know, Thaddeus Kaczynski was talking about that, how they've got us thinking two contradictory thoughts at once. And then I think that there are, you know, bureaucrats who think that they're, in fact, the majority of them probably think they're trying to help us, including like the COVID bureaucrats. But then there are probably some others who know the score.
Well, I'm talking about the current government, okay? The current government in the United States and Canada and Australia and, you know, other places in the West, they are working against their own citizens. You know, I mean, even the lockdowns, they destroy your businesses, you know?
Well, let me question that. Okay, so, like, right now the Chinese are locking down like crazy. Is that because the Chinese government hates Chinese people, or is it because it's like a dry run for another bioweapon attack? And maybe the COVID was an American bioweapon targeting the Chinese economy. And when the, you know, when the American government was locking down and doing these COVID things, sure, they probably knew that face masks didn't really work, but hey, it's a good signaling device to get everybody all, you know, aware that there is this problem. And I think there are a lot of sincere people who really were pursuing these idiotic COVID policies out of more or less good intentions. And then if you look at the top level of the Machiavellians, the people who are actually pulling this stuff off, sure, there might be, some of them might be Malthusians who want to reduce the population and have these nefarious plans to do terrible things to us. But you might also have some Platonic guardians who are looking at the big picture and saying, you know, here in the United States, we are gobbling up a grotesquely outsized share of the world's resources, and we need to keep it that way. I think there's a famous strategist who said that after World War II. So now we're selling worthless green paper to the world in return for real goods and services, and we've got this nice big chunk of land here in North America off the beaten path, producing a lot of stuff. Our people are really spoiled, and we want to keep it that way, but it's going to be really hard because the rest of the world is catching up with us. You know, we were like the West. We were like 60-70% of global GDP just a few decades ago, and now we're down below 50%. We're heading for 20-something percent real soon. This could be a huge disaster, and how are we going to keep this empire going, this empire that depends on printing green paper and exchanging it for real goods and services, and then building all kinds of military stuff and putting it all over the world and holding guns and knives at people's throats and saying, keep taking our green paper, give us advantageous terms of trade, blah, 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 do things our way or else. So that's how this empire works that way, and that empire does trickle down to all the slobs in Walmart who have really easy lives compared to people in most parts of the world. So if you're a Platonic guardian running the American empire, you're saying, yeah, you know, harming China's economy with a bioweapon, well, it was a nice idea. It really was a good idea. It's too bad it blew back. It's going after Russia. We got to do this. We got to figure out a way to, you know, to blow up Russia, China, and Iran, especially China. But right now we can get Russia, so let's pick them off. We can lure them into a bear trap. And we're doing this on behalf of the American empire and ultimately the American people who feed off the crumbs falling from the table of people like us, the oligarchs at the top, right? So they may be thinking like that. They may not be just totally, you know, hey, let's kill all these ordinary people, right?
But Kevin, let's re-examine two of your contentions you mentioned just now, that it was an American bioweapon, all right, and that it was a blowback, that they did not intend all the bad consequences. I'm sorry about all the dogs barking in the background. I'm in an alley.
I think they agree. They agree with you. They're barking at me.
No, they disagree with me. That's why they
Okay, good.
So it was an American bioweapon. And it was a blowback that caused all the horrible consequences. Okay, let's think about that. I don't think it was a blowback because I think they intended all the horrible consequences. Okay, including the lockdowns and especially the vaccine. And I think another main objective that they had, I mean, by they, I mean the leaders of the West, so-called West, they wanted to introduce a kind of social credit system that China already had. Okay, with a health passport, or they can call it whatever else next. You know, the food ration card. What it means is that they want to control every aspect of your life, which China already has. So this leads to the point that China already was totalitarian. China is totalitarian. China did not need COVID to introduce these extreme measures, but the West did. All right. So why is China locking down its people now? This is very baffling because it's hurting its own economy by doing so. You know, Shanghai is locked down for over a month now, and Beijing is starting to be locked down. So there is a suggestion that this is their way of hurting the U.S. because they can withstand these lockdowns, but the U.S. will really suffer because China's denying the U.S. of many components, of many merchandises, of many, you know, things that it needs for its own economy. You know, so China is accelerating the collapse of the American economy by imposing these lockdowns on its own population. So this is like a disguised embargo. And I'm just throwing that out. I'm not sure I'm 100% convinced by it, but it makes as much sense as anything else right now, because why are they doing these seemingly self-destructive acts?
Yeah, I don't understand it either. And I guess that's as good a theory as any. And it seems like there's kind of a perfect storm coming, with the wheat and the energy being taken off the market because of the Ukraine situation. And the economy, of global economy, is still kind of reeling post-COVID and hasn't really fully started up. And then these supply chain disruptions as well. So, yeah, that may, you know, I don't know why else China would be doing that. With the Omicron COVID thing, I don't see why that would be considered so dangerous that they have to take such extreme measures. And what's really odd about this is, if Ron Unz, with his that COVID ebook of his, our COVID-19 catastrophe, that does lay out some, what I think is pretty convincing evidence that there was a U.S. bio attack on China and Iran that probably unleashed it, that if that's the case, then why would the West basically screw up and just let it run wild while China would totally lock down against it? I mean, maybe China's paranoid, but if China should see that if the West sent it to them, and the West obviously knows about this virus, lets it run wild, has given up containing it, what's the advantage for China to contain it? So it is puzzling, and your guess is as good as any.
Yeah, well, I'll just discuss briefly. UNS is stuck on, on the bioweapon, U.S. bioweapon angle. He doesn't go any further. He doesn't see that this weapon is used against the American population purposely. That's why I decided he's a fraud, okay? He mocks people who question the vaccine issue, the lockdown issues, okay? So he doesn't go any further than that. He's stuck
I don't know. I think he's kind of gotten pretty reasonable about that. I've raised it with him, and he hasn't mocked me.
Well, he mocked me, okay? And he mocked other people. I mean, he ridiculed these concerns, and he doesn't talk about Albert Bula, okay? His Jewish buddy, okay? Who's killing billions of people, okay? Or is trying to, all right? So my definition of a limited hangout website is that it talks about shit that you can't solve and to distract you from things that you can still do something about. And the genocide in progress is the vaccine and the lockdowns and the starvation. All these things, were started with the COVID crisis, okay? So until you go there, you are a fraud. You can talk about the Holocaust all you want. That's 80 years ago, all right? So if you're not talking about the crimes that are right in front of you, then you have a serious problem, because, unless you're really stupid or something, or you're deflecting people's attention away from the, like the house is burning down. You're talking about some shit that happened 80 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you can argue that from the other side, that if indeed this was a U.S. bio attack on China, which is, we don't have to step very far outside of the fairly standard historical paradigm to expect that would happen. Like, you would expect it. You say, okay, we've got the U.S. is the number one power, and the number one power is always going to do what it can to preempt the rise of the number two power. This is how the big wars always start. And so the U.S. is going to go to war against China to stop its rise. How's it going to do that? Well, the engine of China's rise is its economy. So the U.S. is going to find a way to go to war against China's economy. What will that be? Well, Robert Cadillac, who Trump appointed as his bioweapons czar in 2017, is a lifelong adherent of the belief that the best way to wage deniable economic warfare is through biological weapons. And there's a long history of U.S. biological attacks on a long list of countries. So Cadillac is just kind of the latest iteration of this, but he's kind of openly enthusiastic about it. And then China's pork and chicken supply kind of just mysteriously died after drones flew over their farms in 2018 and 2019. So it there's that ABC News smoking gun video. So there's this really strong case where you don't even have to diverge very much from what kind of everybody in the universities and the top level media knows about history and current events to say, yeah, I mean, this is just like smoking gun obvious that it was a U.S. bioattack. And then you look at what happened in Iran and it becomes even more obvious. So then.
Kevin, I agree with you. I agree with you, everything you just said. But yeah. We can't stop there, okay? This is also a weapon against the American people and people in the West, okay? And a lot of it is hysteria.
Well, that could be true.
So they're using the COVID to lock people down, you know, to introduce the social credit system. They're borrowing this trick from China. So until you reach the next step and say, wait a second, it's not just against China or Iran. It's also a weapon, even if mostly psychological, against the American people. And one of the main instruments is the damn vaccine. I mean, they're killing people literally. All right. So until you until you mention Rochelle Walensky and Albert Bourla as guilty of genocide, you're not going far enough. Okay. I mean, that's the real crime right now. Okay. So we agree that it is aimed at China. It was aimed at China and Iran, but it is being acted on, the citizens of the West, and it's still going on, okay? Despite the distraction from the Ukrainian war and now the abortion controversy, okay? So they're not done with the vaccine yet. So that's something that Americans and people in the West can do something about, and they try. Some of them did try. So anyone who tried to steer the conversation away from that is serving the criminals.
Well, from just for the sake of argument, Ron's point of view might be that the perpetrators of this realized they were so sloppy that there was a danger they might get caught with that attack on China and Iran, that they actually would prefer to have a wild and crazy, super populist and often unsophisticated conversation that's focusing on other issues, so that the mainstream can demonize the COVID dissidents as a bunch of louts and kind of, you know, low education people and so on,
but
so they
Kevin,
can get a majority
Kevin,
to go along with their
Ron process. Never talk about the vaccines as a weapon, okay? Kept knocking that down. And
well,
I
don't think he believes they are. I mean, he probably would think that the
how stupid can he be, man? Seriously, because so many people have been injured. I mean, in Vietnam, I know people who've been injured. All right. So, I mean, we all know people who've been injured. Unless Ron has no social life and doesn't deal with anybody, he must know people who've been injured. He can't really believe that. All right. And even if he believes that, he should allow people who question it. You know, he allowed just about everything, all kinds of weird shit on there. All right. I mean, he I remember an article when the guy questioned the existence of the Roman Empire, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He allows that. I mean, you know, this is a crime right in front of our face, man. And people all over the world are outraged over this.
Well, but,
right?
Mike Whitney's articles actually have carried, you know, the point of view you're expressing pretty forcefully and gotten huge readership. So I don't think it's really been suppressed. I think Ron has kind of, you know, rolled his eyes a few times maybe, or expressed, you know, his take on these things. But I would have to say, like, you know, every outlet on the internet has got, you know, something I'm not going to 100% agree with. But the ones that I like are the ones that err, for the most part, on the side of free speech. They're never perfect, though. Like at Veterans Today,
well, listen, it's not really about free speech. Because the Jews always use free speech as a wedge to corrupt society. You know, they squeeze in all kinds of weird shit, and they say, well, you got to allow it because it's free speech. You know, whether it's pornography or, Howard Stern is free speech, you know. Jerry Springer.
I'm talking about the kind of commentary we do, right?
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, Ron Unz, you know, I realize, wait a second. I realized when people call me a gook on Unz Review, I thought it was these glitches, you know, like Ron just missed these comments. But then I realized, wait a second, maybe he wants these whites to act as badly as possible, you know, because if you search on Unz Review, like the word nigger, it shows up all the time, you know. And listen, I'm not so uptight that you can't use a bad word. But these people use these words freely because they're in a forum that is welcome. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is that, I mean, if I invite you to my house, Kevin, all right, and there are 20 Vietnamese guests, and they all treat you well, one guy certainly call you something, and I don't say something as the host, then there's a problem. And Ron Un's he's going against his own policy. You're not supposed to attack people like that, but he allows it. So, and you know, don't think that he allows everything, because if you make him look really foolish, he'll censor your comment. People have come to me and say, "Well, my comment wasn't allowed." So that's a charade, man. You can call him a kike. That's fine, because he wants whites to behave like savages. So you can call people nigger, kike, hooks, whatever, but you can't make Ron Un's look too stupid. All right. So he allows Whitney, a control opposition must allow something. You can't, you know, outright ban everything. But he made it very clear to me that he did not welcome my articles about the vaccine issue. And eventually he made it pretty clear to me that he didn't want me there anymore. All right. So I'm just saying, moving forward, I think it will become more obvious that Ron Unz is a fraud. And, you know, for your own sake, maybe you should think about giving him cover, man, because your appearance there and Robert Craig Roberts, another people, legitimate writers, give Ron Unz the cover that he needs to push his real agenda.
Well, okay? I don't really see that. Like, I think his stuff, the stuff he publishes there, is really good. I mean, it's consistently very, very high level. Compares favorably with pretty much any writing on current events that's out there anywhere. And there's a lot of other good stuff on that site, as well as some not such great stuff with this, as you said, this kind of huge proportion of sort of racialist, white nationalist, racialist type stuff that, you know, the excuse, of course, is that that's censored everywhere else, which it is increasingly. But it does kind of skunk by association all of this other good stuff. So, yeah, I kind of agree with that critique. But then if you're going to compare that site with what else is out there, you know, like I also publish at Veterans Today, and they were fanatically pro-vaccine. The top editors were fanatically pro-vaccine, you know, totally opposed to the whole populist, you know, COVID rebellion, and vastly, you know, about 10,000 times more obnoxious than Ron Unz would ever be about that. And somehow I and a few other people who have views closer to yours managed to stay there because they let us keep posting. And so I keep posting every once in a while. You know, Gordon Duff would say something really obnoxious in some editor's note added to the front of my article. But ultimately, well, okay, so it's his website. I guess I can live with a little bit of that. And you compare that to every place else, you know, like Counterpunch, they won't even let you talk about 9/11, certainly not the way I would talk about it, much less Jewish issues. You just look at any website, even like Global Research, the few that are fairly good and dealing with the kind of stuff we deal with. I think we're going to have these problems. There's always going to be a problem with any of them. So,
it is a desert, man. It is a desert. You know, the American public forum is a wasteland, you know.
Well, but there's still good stuff. And so if you can just kind of, you know, sift through the bad. That's like what Ron said about the comments. You know, like I've asked him about it. It's like, you know, what's what? There are all these garbage comments and all these racism. Yeah, but you know, you just zip through these comments and ignore all the stupid ones, and then you find some amazingly good stuff in the comments. And, okay, whatever. Yeah. So if you take that attitude towards everything on the internet, and you don't expect anything to be consistently what you would call really good and write about everything. You know,
let's get back to, I mean, you know, I published there for years, man, and he never objected to anything I wrote on any issue. Suddenly he started complaining to me about the vaccine problem, which I found bizarre because that's like the number one public crisis right now. You know,
well, I had the same problem in spades at Veterans Today. It was worse. It was a million times worse there. Yeah, so what's going on?
Wait a second, man. You know, you were cool with everything else. All of a sudden, you worry about this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what's up? What's wrong with you, man? And anyway, he made it abundantly clear that he didn't want me there. So, but fine. I mean, I feel so much better moving forward. But let's get back to the vaccine.
But interestingly, both of these sites, Lynn, both the UNS Review and Veterans Today, are back publishing a lot of really good stuff about Ukraine. So, I mean, they were both, you know.
Yeah, because they know we can't do shit about Ukraine, man. I'm saying, you know, like, the limited hangout space is that they'll allow you to talk about things you can't solve. You know, the Ukraine situation is going to move forward. But the vaccine issue is something that is very personal because, you know, people have relatives and friends and maybe themselves are being hurt by it. And that's something that can still be dealt with. I mean, we're talking about lives, man. Millions of lives being, you know, destroyed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm back in Vietnam and I know people here. Later on this morning, I'm going to see a friend. You know, he took the jab, two jabs, and he's a mess. I'm going to see him later today. So, I mean, we all know people like that. Okay, so I mean, it's a very urgent issue.
I don't think I do. I mean, I know two people who were hospitalized with COVID-like symptoms after being vaccinated, and then one, Jim Fetzer, who was hospitalized with a COVID diagnosis, I think, without being vaccinated. But other than that, my whole family of sheeple, I'm not talking about my wife and sons, but my extended family has all been vaccinated, and I haven't heard a peep about any negative symptoms from them. Well, they're so brainwashed, even if they had them, maybe they wouldn't notice. But and I guess I don't know that many vaccinated people, though, maybe. But no, I haven't really met anybody who's described these kinds of problems.
Yeah, well, maybe you spare. Maybe your extended family is part of the network that's spared.
Maybe they're all reptilians. Maybe I'm part reptilian.
Your reptilian blood prevents you from getting hurt. Don't tell me you got vaccinated. No, you did not.
Are you kidding? No,
I don't know, man.
If they come after me with a syringe, that's it. I will die fighting back on that one for sure. I basically agree with you. The way I would phrase it, based on the stuff I've been reading all this stuff from the dissident doctors and you know, I've had Meryl Nass on the show a bunch of times. And so, I mean, the way I'd phrase it is not so much this is like a kill shot that's necessarily, well, who knows what the long-term effects are, but in the short and medium terms, it just looks like, I would describe it as, it sure looks to me like the downside is a lot worse than any benefits. And these benefits that they describe turn out to be very short, impermanent, and then you have to get jabbed again. And each time you get jabbed, the benefits last for a shorter period, and by the time then when it wears off, you're actually worse off than you were before, at least in terms of getting the likelihood of getting infected with COVID. So when they say they're safe and effective, that's not true. Number one, they're not safe. There are very good arguments that at least 100,000, maybe up to 300,000 or something Americans have died from these jabs, and they certainly probably haven't saved that many people by any means. And so the safe and effective thing.
I don't think he'll save anybody, but they can't kill people immediately, or who's going to agree to be jabbed. You know, it works on you over time, but let me give you the two concrete examples. The guy I'm going to see later today is my son, and he's a translator and a writer and a critic. Okay. I've known him for 20 years, over 20 years. All right. So, I mean, he's like, I don't know, 64, 65, something like that. But he was in great health up to a year ago. I mean, he's very youthful looking. Okay, when I saw him about 10 days ago, he couldn't talk to me. We were sitting next to each other having dinner. You know, he would just grin, you know, and, you know. I mean, the guy was just weird, man. I mean, it's just tragic to see. And this happened immediately after he got jabbed. All right, he was hospitalized. And he was eager to be jabbed. All right, so so it's too late now. I mean, you know, his life is ruined. He's not going to write anymore. I mean, he published his last book only, 2017 or something. And he was still writing. He was still active. But his life is ruined. And my landlady in Vũng Tàu, you know, she said that her health is down to maybe 40% of what it was. Okay? And these people believe in the jabs.
Wow.
All right? And
yeah,
and Vietnam has been traumatized into believing the jab because people wearing masks left and right here, man. It's kind of farcical. They go into the ocean. They swim with the mask on in the ocean.
Seriously?
I couldn't believe it myself. You know, the first woman I saw swimming with a mask on, I'm thinking, she's a weirdo. And then I saw other people doing it. Okay, so Vietnam is like this big joke of COVID hysteria, except that everything is still is functioning normally. Okay, all the restaurants, all the cafes, everything, because people need to eat. They need to make money. And, you know, Vietnamese love to eat. So, you know,
they're not forcing you to mask in the cafes and restaurants, are they?
No. And they're no longer penalizing people for walking down the street. I stopped wearing a mask because at first I thought maybe, you know, in public I must wear a mask. But I have friends here who never wore a mask and say, well, actually they had to a little while back, but they said that you don't need to worry about that because they're no longer penalizing people. The signs, they have all these billboards out saying you're going to be fined so much money if you don't have a mask on, but it's not enforced. Okay. But what's sad is that you see toddlers, man, 2 or 3 year olds playing in the park with a mask on, you know?
So are you wondering whether going back to Vietnam was a good idea?
No, I'm fine because everything is functioning here. Okay. All the cafes, all the restaurants are functioning normally. I would say 99% of them. All right. So life is normal. It's just that people riding their motorbikes around with a mask on. And then
that's
go to the restaurant and take the mask off. Okay? It doesn't make any sense. They're sitting among people, they're taking the mask off, and then they put the mask back on when they get on a motorbike.
Yeah. I find masking extremely alienating and obnoxious. I mean, not just because it's this mimetic virus that all these people are just doing because everybody else is doing it mindlessly, but also because it hides the facial expressions. And it really messes with the communication for me. Like I have a harder time understanding what people are saying, and the warmth of the communication is gone when you can't see the facial expressions. So it's just a nightmare for me that people do this, especially because it's not effective. There just is not evidence that it's effective. So we assume it isn't. And
for children, it destroys their development, man. You know, if you're like a 3 year old and you can't see, adults' mouths, as they talk, you don't even learn how to talk properly.
Yeah, maybe they're purposely trying to raise a generation of zombies. And, you know, the phone, the way everybody's carrying their phones around and doing these idiotic kinds of apps, you know, TikTok nonsense, is sometimes it looks like they're really going out of their way to dumb us down even more than in the past.
Yeah, we're dumb enough already. But yesterday I walked by a playground. There were kids, 7 or 8 years old playing basketball. And like most of them had masks on.
Seriously?
Yeah.
We saw someone, my son and I went to Richland Center, Wisconsin, where there's a nice basketball court with a soft, relatively soft surface, which is good for my 63-year-old joints. And, we're playing basketball. There's a sign there that says, something like, players must wear masks. I mean, we just laughed. I mean, who's going to wear a mask playing basketball?
Yeah. Yeah. Readers should go onto my blog to see a couple of my photos of Vietnamese in the ocean wearing masks. Now, you can hardly breathe with it, without water, if there's water on your mask, how the hell are you going to breathe at all? And there's nobody around these.
It sounds like they're waterboarding themselves, Lynn.
Yeah, there you go. Maybe that's the next step. Hey, maybe people in the West should start doing this, right? They behind Vietnamese, man. They wear masks, but they're not waterboarding themselves.
Well, this is why they want you to wear masks, is because then you'll go in the ocean or the lake and you'll waterboard yourself, and that way you'll be able to torture yourself into admitting and confessing that deep within inside you there is a right wing extremist, a conspiracy theorist.
Well, the Vietnamese, how can they be branded as right-wing extremists, you know? So that's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of an American thing and even a European thing now, but maybe not so much in Vietnam. Well, the good news, though, is that the right-wing extremists are now hip and cool, apparently. I was talking about this with Thaddeus Kaczynski in the first hour. There's this Vanity Fair article that just came out about the so-called right-wing extremists, which are really just the red-pilled people. And apparently it's now kind of a fad. It's becoming popular among younger people to be red-pilled. Although it's some of them are red-pilled in kind of weird ways that I wouldn't necessarily identify with myself. But you know, do you think that we're going to live long enough to be cool again, Lynn?
Probably not. I'm very pessimistic. But just a note on right-wing extremism. Vietnam is technically a communist country, all right? But there's no Jewish thinking left here, all right? By that, I mean there's no talks of There's no bullshit.
Well, you better import. You better import some Jews then.
Yeah, maybe. I could use a good deli down the street. But anyway, all the slogans that put up by the government stress nationalism, okay, which is the opposite of Jewish thinking, of communism. All right. So there's no universal brotherhood, Marx. There's none, zero. Even the quotation that they put up by Ho Chi Minh stress nationalism. So the Communist Party of Vietnam justifies its continued existence by nationalist slogans. Okay, so nationalism is the way to move forward, at least for Vietnam and obviously for Russia and anyway for any country that wants to survive. Because that just makes sense, man. You need to take care of your own culture, of your own interests, preferably without stepping on anyone's toes. But there's nothing wrong with defending yourself, man. Defending your language, your culture, your heroes, your military heroes, reclaiming all that and rejecting any sort of globalism, internationalism, any sort of bullshit utopian talk. Just take care of yourselves first. And that's how you survive.
But Lynn, if the whole world turns into a bunch of nationalists, how are the neoliberal oligarchs going to take over the world and institute a one-world government?
Well, countries that want to go along with that, go ahead, man. Just leave me out of it. Leave the Vietnamese out of it. And, leave whatever. I mean, go ahead and buy into all that bullshit. But, the Vietnamese have experienced it, all this weird talk about, universal brotherhood and all this crap. And, really, I mean, I don't think Vietnamese were ever good Marxists, So there's not even any talk about class struggle in Vietnam. None of the slogans address that. You know why? Because the richest people are the party members, the top echelon party members. Okay? They own a lot of land. They own a lot of nightclubs. So you can't even talk about that.
So when your family fled communist Vietnam and came to America and you grew up and then you had to flee communist America to go back to Vietnam.
To go back to nationalist Vietnam.
It's full circle.
Which is masquerading as communism.
Things have gone full circle. The liberals are now the conservatives. The conservatives are the liberals. Everything's mixed up. If you're a peacenik and a civil libertarian, as I told Thaddeus Kaczynski, now you're a right-wing extremist. The world has become almost indecipherable. Maybe that's how they want it. Well, Lynn, I think we're at the end of the show. So let's send people to your two websites. You have a Substack, lynndin.substack.com, and you have that Postcards from the End of the American Empire site as well. And I've linked those at the radio blog, which people can find by going to truthjihad.com and clicking on the radio schedule link. So thank you, Lynn. I hear the music. That means we'll have to get you back again now that you're in the congenial time zone for my live radio show. Keep up the great work. God bless. Take care.
Great talking to you, Kevin, as always. Thanks, man.
That's Rick Lynn. There's a fire. There's a fire. There's a fire.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law, spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern.